Welcome to The Women's Wisdom, Our Journey in Emergency Medicine podcast, a production of the Women in Emergency Medicine section of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine. Join Drs. Molly Estes and Liz Calhoun as they are joined by prominent women in emergency medicine and other special guests.
Hello, and welcome to yet another episode of the Women's Wisdom podcast. I am Dr. Liz Calhoun. I am an attending emergency physician at Mercy Fitzgerald Hospital in Derby, Pennsylvania.
And hello, everyone. My name is Molly Estes. I'm clinical faculty at Loma Linda University in Southern California.
We are welcoming a very special guest, Dr. Vanessa Hanick, onto our show today.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for the introduction. I'm also an emergency medicine physician. Currently in the United States Army, working at Carl R. Darnall Army Medical Center in Fort Cavazos, Texas. Also clinical faculty, and I help out with the ultrasound fellowship there at Fort Cavazos. Standard disclaimer for all employees of the military that the thoughts and opinions in this podcast are mine and don't represent those of the DOD or the United States Army or the government or any of its entities.
Vanessa, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into medicine, particularly human medicine and military medicine as well.
Well, I had a little bit of a convoluted path. Starting in high school, I was sort of interested in science. I was kind of one of those people, but didn't really know what I wanted to do. And when I got to college, I sort of followed the kind of common pathway. I went to Baylor University and the common pathway. A lot of people were pre-med. So I was like, that sounds great. Let's do that. But what I really thought I wanted to do was to be a veterinarian, and was sort of going down that path, interned for an equine veterinarian when I was after my freshman year, but shortly realized that veterinary medicine wasn't for me because I cannot handle animals injured and suffering, believe it or not. And so the natural path after that was like, I guess I'll just do human medicine. That sounds good. It was really, truly at first just sort of by default that I was into science and what else was I going to do with it? And struggled a little bit as a student. I wasn't the best student for anyone listening who might be in the same path. I was a mediocre grades, very mediocre MCAT score, and actually took three times to get into medical school. But ultimately that gave me a little extra time to really figure out what I wanted to do and actually provided me with kind of my epiphany moment of what I wanted to do. I was home visiting my parents somewhere around 2007, I think, something like that, and had gone to visit the family of a friend of mine who was killed in Iraq while fighting in the army a few years earlier. And while I was there, had the opportunity to meet a friend of his who was actually with him when he was killed. This friend, his name is Rich. He was also injured in that attack and had the privilege of hearing the story of being injured and the care he received at the point of injury and all of the care that he received at each level of care beyond and what his experience was. And it was really in that moment that I knew that that was what I wanted to do. There's really, you know, no better way for me to use what I love, what I like, what I'm good at, at least moderately good at, than to give back in that way. So that was really the start of it for me. I didn't immediately apply to medical school after that. I went to grad school first and then kind of slowly made my way to medical school. And I went to Uniformed Services University, the military med school in Bethesda, Maryland.
So first of all, thank you for your service. And to all of the other guests that we've had on this podcast who serve in the military as well, how has your military experience affected your view on medicine in general? And how has it affected a little bit about just your view about life and the things that you find important and how you define balance in life?
Well, the way that I look at medicine, actually, to sometimes much to the chagrin of our residents, is an outside of the hospital perspective. I routinely say that, you know, I'm not the one who's going to teach you to be the expert in critical care in the emergency department. The one thing that I focus most of my time and energy on is how do you do this when you don't have all of the resources that you would like to have? How do you execute this task or care for this patient or diagnose this disease without a CT scanner, without a nurse by your side, without the guarantee that there's going to be someone on the other end to receive your patient and take care of them. And so that's really what I look at all day, every day, every patient that I see. How would I treat this if I were in the middle of nowhere without anything? And the value in that actually goes far beyond the military. I think I know for sure, as Liz has experienced in resource limited settings with no guarantee of what the future will look like for yourself, for your hospital, for your patients. But also in all of the recent disasters that we've had, all of the goings on in the world, these things really are becoming much more relevant. And I think important for us all to really consider.
I couldn't agree more. It's so funny, as you were talking about that, I remembered a conversation I had with one of my coworkers right in the middle of the thick of COVID, right? Yeah. And both of us have done a little bit of international work. And we were remarking on the fact that we found ourselves better able to cope with the limited resources and the problems that we were facing within our system when we switched over to our international medicine mentality, as opposed to our, I'm supposed to be working at a university hospital mentality. I don't think anybody is within a system right now that isn't strapped in some way, shape, or form. And so that unique perspective and unique skill set and being able to function without all of the things that you are, quote, supposed to have is incredibly valuable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's perhaps something that's missing from the broader medical curriculum are things like rural medicine and disaster medicine, because we just don't know which COVID or which disasters right around the corner that we are going to have to be able to adapt to. So I've been grateful for that. I work in a level 3 trauma center that's very resource limited, but actually was one of the blessings of my career that it taught me to be a better diagnostician and to understand the second and third and fourth levels of care of a patient to make sure they get to the right place, which then served me well on deployment, certainly.
How did that affect you on deployment? Are you able to tell us a little bit, even just in general terms, about some of the things you experienced practicing medicine while deployed?
A lot of it was that resource limitation. And I think one of the most eye-opening challenges, two very eye-opening challenges on deployment, one was that I really had to embrace my education and sometimes really take some risks that made me uncomfortable, sometimes with help and sometimes without, because that was the only option for the patient, whether they be an American patient or a partner force patient, that sometimes, even though I wasn't the best person for the job, I was the best that they were going to get in the moment. And I think in a medical world of zero miss mentality and this expectation of perfection, that was a real eye opener that certainly made me feel uncomfortable. It definitely hasn't helped me overcome, you know, the imposter syndrome that we all talk about or the fear of making mistakes, but it really made me appreciate that sometimes we really do have to embrace that struggle and embrace those challenges. So that was very rewarding. And it gives me a different perspective, again, in the hospital when I approach things like, if someone isn't going to have access to a primary care provider, if they're not going to have access to follow-up, how can I maximize their care right now, just me, still safely and still within, you know, the expectations of care, but it really helps me stretch my practice to provide care to patients who wouldn't otherwise get it. The other thing that I learned that was a real struggle for me that I was completely unprepared for was what it's like to take care of people that you love and care about. We had a fairly small team of people who were routinely going on missions day after day, night after night. And the odds were that I was going to have to take care of one or many of them at some point. And fortunately, we did not have any American casualties or deaths outside of a military working dog. But not having any preparation for how I was going to take care of a friend and remain objective and give them not only the psychological support, but the medical support, and then also deal with the psychological impact that had on me. That was an incredible learning curve that I'm thankful I had, but also something that I talk about frequently too with my learners now.
Well, no kidding. I mean, that is the it shouldn't happen scenario of medicine, right? Like, we are taught from medical school onwards that you do not care for your right. friends or family because you are emotionally compromised. And now you find yourself in a situation where you that is the only thing that you are doing. What a whiplash experience that must have been.
It was, but also very rewarding, because when I went into medicine, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be one of the people that stands between the people I love, my friend Nick, who was killed in Iraq, my friend Rich that I met after the fact, between them and death. And what I realized after I got back was, even though I was never going to be the person at the point of injury putting on tourniquets and saving their lives in that setting, I was still there for that. I was still part of that journey. And I really still did get the fulfillment of being between people I loved and cared about and their medical outcome, whether that be morbidity or mortality. And that was just tremendously rewarding.
There's a lot of stress that goes on in situations like that, even if you do find it rewarding. You're dealing with your own emotional challenges of being deployed and being away from home, and under the high stress situations of taking care of patients. And now you add that extra level of emotional connection. How do you bring resilience into your own life? And how do you process these unique challenges that you face?
Well, that's actually not something I've been very good at. And I think probably in thinking about what I was going to talk about with you guys today, one of my big regrets is not being better at balancing work, life, and the psychological impact of just medicine, even outside of deployment. I was not prepared for the emotional toll of worrying about patients, wondering if you've messed up, wondering if you could have done something better, wondering if, you know, you're going to get that phone call from risk management after the fact. And that has been a real struggle for me. And the best thing that I've had to deal with that are people that understand and people that get it and people that I can talk to about that, that have been there before and can experience that. And I can't put a price on the support I've gotten from people who have been deployed or people who have shared their bad experiences. Because I think sometimes we don't want to, you know, we're all embarrassed about the mistakes we've made and it's hard to share those, but the value in knowing that we've all been there or may be there one day is tremendous. But I do wish I had done a better job at, number one, preparing myself for those psychological burdens, and then really focusing far more on my downtime and spending time investing in myself and my personal life, whether that be, you know, my friends, family, financially, my own personal education. I was not good at that for many, many years, which is a big regret that I have.
I truly appreciate you being vulnerable and saying that, because I think that we all share very similar feelings when it comes to looking back and realizing that we did not allocate, dedicate, make the choice to put our own mental and emotional needs, at least if not first, then at least at a much higher priority than we tend to do. And I really think that the only way that we can begin to change that within our medical culture and continue to change it within our medical training is by more of us being vulnerable and admitting and saying, hey, yeah, this is a place where I wish I would have done better. And now I'm actively trying to do better because I see the value in it. I am relieved that my students and my residents are getting significantly better training in how to do this than I ever received when I was going through training. And I can only hope that we begin to see more and more improved self-care from physicians, appropriate mental and emotional and self support within our systems, because it is a very taxing experience, no matter what your personal experience within the house of medicine might be.
Yeah, and that burden of perfection, like, I can't overstate that. And I think the only way that we can overcome society's expectation for us to be perfect and flawless is to, from within our own culture, give each other permission that that expectation probably won't go away. But the reality is none of us are going to be perfect, and we have to support each other through that. I'm never going to convince the type A person that, you know, it's okay to not be perfect and it's okay to make mistakes, but we still have to say that out loud more than I think that we do.
And you brought up another good point too, about just talking about this and, you know, not being able to leave your worries at work and taking it home and thinking about the patients and wondering what you did. And I feel like at least our generation and emergency medicine was sold a false bill of goods. You know, you say, oh, you leave your job at work, you work a shift and then you go home, but that doesn't actually happen. And it's hard to leave work at work, even though maybe that's one of the reasons why we thought this would be a great specialty. And you're helping us talk about that and say, no, that's actually not what happens. That's not what we need to do as a big collective.
It's such a double-edged sword, right? It's like, hey, congratulations, you're a good person. You care about your people even after you leave work. Hey, darn it, you're a good person. You care about your patients even after you leave work.
And how do we deal with that? I remember one of the questions in my interview by someone I still admire, Dr. Smith, asked me what one of my weaknesses was. And that was one of my known weaknesses. I know that I'm not going to go home and just punch the clock and not worry about my patients. I'm probably going to call them back. And that I got better at that as the years went on, but I still have patients that I'm worried about, partly because of their own disease and pathology and process, but partly, honestly, partly a lot of it is me. And I find myself even saying to patients, you know, here's what I'm thinking is going on, and here's what I think we should do. And if they hesitate, often I have said on many occasions that I'm going to worry about you if you go home, and if we don't, you know, do this, this, or this, or figure this out, I'm going to worry about you. And I don't know that we're good about talking about how to navigate that. What do you do with that? You can't turn it off. I've tried. I think we've all tried. And you can't turn it off, and you can't be perfect.
Can't turn it off and can't be perfect. Wow. That's a book lecture, some sort of title if I ever heard one, right? Well, to switch gears just a little bit, and because I suspect that we've already started touching on this particular topic that you wanted to bring up, you mentioned before we got on the recording that many of the things that you are currently doing in your job are direct reflections of your own personal life experiences of how you ended up in your journey through medicine up until this point. Elaborate on that more for us.
Well, one of them, aside from just military medicine and specifically battlefield medicine or austere resource limited medicine as sort of the impetus for my whole career, one of the things that I found myself over the years as I became junior faculty realizing was that I was never a good learner and was probably not a very good educator either. And I had this realization that despite the fact that we've spent our whole lives learning and we've, as physicians are expected, regardless of our level, intern, second year, third year faculty are expected to be educators, we don't do a very good job, at least in my experience, of teaching how to learn and teaching how to teach. And I was not good at the MCAT. Why wasn't I good at the MCAT? Because I was terrible at studying. And I thought, I'm pretty smart. I've always done okay. Maybe I don't have to try. And I just didn't have any actual strategies for effective learning. And then that turned into not having effective strategies for teaching. And what that has led me to, other than an enjoyment in teaching and getting better at that, is right now I'm doing a doctorate in education, specifically because I wanted to learn how to learn better and learn how to teach better, which has been an incredible experience and incredibly eye-opening. And another thing that I think we've done a disservice for our learners about that. We just aren't giving them the tools that they need to be successful. And they wind up being successful anyway, but what burden are we placing on them because of it? The extra stress of get perfect grades without the tools to do it, be an effective, you know, excellent educator without the tools to do it, deal with your psychological stress without the tools to do it. And so it's all of these things that I experienced that really drove me to explore ways, how do I get better at this? How do I fix this problem? And then how do I translate that into improving other people's experience?
Can you talk a little bit more about how this has impacted your teaching career, your role as an EM educator, and things that you've done to help make it a little easier on your own learners?
Well, I've actually cycled through my approach, and it's been a little bit difficult because I think it changes with the year and the culture and the generation of people. And that's something that I haven't tackled. But really, truly, the way that I've found myself approaching education now, it is in a far more supportive way and in a way that reflects my own experiences. To say, you know, every second year wants to work on efficiency. And my response to them is, I want to help you work on efficiency too. But I'm also going to tell you that I was the least efficient resident in my class. And this is why. And I can help you understand the principles of efficiency, and I can point you to the people who can help you. But I want you to know that it's also okay not to be the most efficient person in your class. It's okay to not see 30 patients in a shift. It's okay to not be perfect and to be okay with not being perfect in that way. So I try to embrace that much more than I used to, and I try to be explicit about it. One of the things I found was that I had these ideas in my mind of how to teach people and what I wanted them to learn and what I wanted them to get from their experience with me. But they didn't get that because I wasn't saying it out loud and I wasn't making it explicitly known to them. Along with that, giving them explicit permission to, you know, work on the things they want to work on and approach things the way that they want to approach them within a right and left limit, and to also just do your best today in this thing. And over 3 years, you're going to get to a point where you feel good about most things, hopefully. So I've been a lot more deliberate and explicit about my intentions in teaching. And I've been a lot more deliberate in trying to specifically understand where people are in that moment, in that day, and to meet them where they are with that, regardless of their overall progress in emergency medicine and position in the class. Because at the end of the day, that's really the only way we can truly individualize education, I think, because everybody's on their same path. We can't change the curriculum necessarily based on each individual learner, but we can meet each individual learner where they are in that moment on that shift.
I mean, that just makes my medical education heart weep with joy. If I could have that on a bumper sticker, I think I probably would, because it's so true, right? Just like in our departments, there is no two shifts that are exactly the same. There are never two learners that are exactly the same. My God, my own personal learning needs vary sometimes minute to minute over the course of a shift. And so as in all things emergency medicine, flexibility is key, but not just flexibility, but just an open-mindedness and a practicality to problem solving in order to be human and realistic with each other, right?
Yeah. And that's not to say, I'll tell you that there was a long time where I struggled a lot with, you know, why don't the residents understand and appreciate the things the way that I see them? Why do they not get the importance of this thing? Why can't they see the relevance the way that I see it, or trust me that this is relevant? And it really was only until I started learning about how people learn and adult learning theory and all these things that I'm like, well, no kidding that they didn't appreciate that my, you know, 5 years out experience was relevant to them right now in the hospital. So now how do I make that relevant to them, or be okay when they don't necessarily in that moment believe me or accept that? And to be okay with that, and to know I'm still doing my best to support their well-rounded education, even if they don't love it in the moment. But again, to be explicit about, why am I doing this? Why do I think you need to know? Why is this important for you? Maybe not right now, but in the future. And that has helped a lot.
So kind of in those same lines, and to try to tie a bow on this conversation, because unfortunately, We never have enough time for these. Like, let's be honest. We Liz and I are constantly saying how we wish that we were just sitting in a coffee shop or a bar or somewhere, someplace, just able to talk for hours. But that being said, if you were going to look back at yourself at X point in your life, you know, kind of one of those key decision points, or if you were to identify with one of your trainees and really see yourself in them, what is maybe one thing that you wish somebody would have said to you, or maybe that you wish you would have heard somebody say to you at that moment in time?
I think I wish that when I was new faculty, that someone sat me down and helped me to really do some internal reflection about what was going to help me feel fulfilled while also helping me feel like I'm contributing. Because I found myself working day and night, hour after hour, spending all of my free time working for the residency, for the hospital. And years later, after, you know, I feel like I've made some good contributions. Some of them have gone by the wayside. Some of them were appreciated. Some of them weren't. I find myself looking back and regretting that I spent so much time and energy in all of these other things to prove myself, to look like I was contributing, to make sure that everybody knew that I was a hard worker and that I was part of the team, when I could have done many of those things or some of those things and still been a good contributor and a good team player, but also spent more time taking care of myself and making sure that I felt fulfilled, and that when I looked back in 5 years, that I could say, I feel good about those things that I did.
I think maybe that's the most important lesson of all, and one that most of us struggle to learn, is how to take care of yourself and how to spend enough time filling your own cup so that you can help fill someone else's
right
in the process.
And I do feel good about all of that hard work, but I still have regrets that, you know, could I have been moonlighting more? Could I have been reading more? Could I have been pursuing other interests or activities or visiting my family more? And I think that we really have to mentor each other and, again, give each other permission that you can say no, you don't have to do it all. And that doesn't devalue you as a person or a team member or a worker. And you can still feel fulfilled and feel like you're contributing, even if you say no.
Well, Dr. Hanek, thank you so much for joining us, for taking time out of your busy schedule in order to be able to do this recording with us. I really, truly, as a colleague and friend, appreciate a lot of what you've had to say. I think that we need to all do a better job at moving these messages forward. So thank you again for your service. Thank you for your life lessons. And thank you for your time and your wisdom, and for sharing your journey.
Thank you for having me. This has been absolutely wonderful. And I'm happy to, if anyone needs to reach out if there are further questions, I'm on X and I'm on Facebook, and I can share my information as well.
Thank you all. And we'll see you on the next episode of the Women's Wisdom Podcast.
We hope you have enjoyed this podcast from the American Academy of Emergency Medicine. AAEM is a nonprofit professional association of over 8,000 emergency physicians dedicated to board certification and democratic group practice. For more information about AAEM, visit our website at www.aaem.org.